This morning I'll be preaching on the upcoming national election in 2020, 367 days away. I will not be endorsing any candidates. I will try to highlight some of the underlying moral and ethical issues worth trying to recognize and understand, and that's kind of my motivation whenever I preach politics. Henry Frankfurt begins this morning's first reading by noting that one of the most salient aspects of contemporary culture is how saturated it is, top to bottom, with BS. We all know this, and we all contribute to it, the philosopher goes on. Its ubiquity we take for granted, as well as our ability to recognize BS and avoid being taken in. We assume this. We think that's true. Frankfurt's point, essentially, is that we live in a world of phoniness. Perhaps this was always so, but he is inclined to think that it's getting worse. We're so bombarded by media nowadays that there's more of everything, including more BS. And then there's modern advertising. 100 years ago, advertising was all about product information. But starting in the 1920s and accelerating dramatically after the Second World War, advertisers have used increasingly sophisticated, half-hidden, subliminal gimmickry. They've become magicians in the marketing of image, personality, and lifestyle to stimulate our artificial cravings. Is it any wonder that our people, the American public, are the most addicted people on earth? The truth is, there has never been a culture anywhere in the world like ours, where by the time a child is 5 years old, she has heard hundreds of thousands of mistruths. Advertisements inviting her to enjoy some special cereal or toy or what have you. What's Bob Dylan say? Advertisements that con you into thinking you're the one who can do what's never been done, who can win what's never been won. Meanwhile, life goes on all around you. Yes, meanwhile. The same techniques that stimulate consumer desire in unsuspecting toddlers can be and are being used to sell candidates and political hocus-pocus to grown-ups. The 2010 Citizens United Supreme Court decision stunned democracy advocates and trampled a number of campaign finance laws that have been in place for generations. A slim five-justice majority of the Supreme Court ruled that corporations, including for-profit corporations, do indeed have a right to spend as much money as they want to elect or defeat candidates in our elections, effectively granting corporations the same First Amendment free speech protections granted to real, live citizens. What we've been seeing and hearing in the election campaigns since Citizens United, the vulgarity, the commercialism, is a result of that decision. A clear and longtime, longtime member of the congregation I was serving in 2016 in suburban Los Angeles came in and talked to me about a month after that election and subsequent to a couple of my sermons, which I was trying to focus on things about the political changes that we were witnessing. And she asked me, how can I steel myself against the worst of this? And how is it possible to find the detachment and awareness needed to participate in the unfolding political drama without losing faith or the hope and attention good citizenship requires? Well, okay, dear former member, and all of you current members, let me do my best to make the case for just that. Although I'll be speaking on political issues, I want to make it clear from the outset that I am not called to the role of political commentator, and I do not aspire to be one. Unitarian Universalism is a faith community. We are a religion, not a political front group. And as a Unitarian Universalist minister, it's my calling to consider aloud the moral and ethical issues at play and underlying our social and political landscape. That's what I will try to do this morning. That's what I try to do as best I can all the time. Also, from the outset, I want to make clear how our UU faith is founded upon, comes out of, really, organically, not only biblical tradition, but also that of classical Greece. That just as the Hebraic and Jesus traditions have, in a certain mythical sense, taught us breadth of heart, the Socratic and Platonic myths have taught us depth of mind, or how to think. It's the Greeks who taught us how to think. As the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, more or less the originator of process theology, allegedly quipped, 2,500 years of Western philosophy are but a footnote to Plato. Whether that's true or not, the ideas and ideals contemplated by the philosophers of antiquity clearly animated the minds and imaginations and hearts of our country's founders, and can still inspire great and powerful deeds by courageous patriots today. Seven years ago, while serving as interim minister of the First Unitarian Society of San Francisco, I joined their church choir as part of a cultural exchange to Cuba. One thing that immediately impressed me on that island was that in Cuba, nothing is for sale. There are no for sale signs around anywhere. Cars, apartments, boats, one either barters for these things or forget about it. How different from the United States, where everything's for sale. Offer the right combination of carrot and stick, and no one, we are told, can refuse. As noted earlier, ours is the first culture organized in such a manner, where thanks to advertising, the average American kindergartner has been deluged with well over 100,000 hyped up consumer claims, BS by any standard, before she or he has even learned how to read. Modern advertising uses demographic and now psychographic research to identify and then target blocks of buyers, of people rather, as buyers of their products. Lifestyle images are given priority over the presentation of facts. Politicians' imitation of mass marketing strategies has made modern political discourse undistinguishable from advertising. If, as many political conservatives believe, people are motivated solely by economics, by the marketplace, then it follows that they have no rights, really, except consumer rights. But if that's true, sadly, the central principles of democracy are gravely threatened, a threat made greater by the assumption gained from our advertising-dominated culture that the same process as that by which advertisers now sell their commodities should guide the selection of political leaders. And what is that process? Professor Henry Frankfurt labels it humbug, or more simply, bullshit. Raphael Demos calls it sophistry. In either case, its essence is distraction. Distracting the listener from what's really at issue. That's what I want to bring to your attention today, the effort to distract our awareness from what is really going on. And what is really going on? Externally, the democratic experiment. So my paternal grandmother By the time I'm six, she's saying, and what are you going to do to support the democratic experiment, Master Stephen? But it's still in the back of my head. So externally, what's going on, this democratic experiment? Can free people govern themselves and remain free? We've been at it in this country for 243 years, and it is still up for grabs. It is always up for grabs, always imperiled. Now, that's the political atmosphere. Internally, what's going on, that is within each person's heart or psyche, what's going on is the drama of self-discovery and fulfillment, what the transcendentalists called self-culture, what the universalists of old called living in the greater hope. Carl Jung called it individuation. Martin Luther King called it learning to love. Plato called it simply philosophy. For Plato and his students, philosophy was way more than a head trip. It was a sacred endeavor, a cleansing of the soul. And a bona fide philosopher for Plato was a certain sort of person, recognized not so much for the topics she or he discusses, as for the manner in which it's done. Personal unaffectedness, leisureliness in argument combined with wholeheartedness and zeal, along with deep respect for his or her opponent's point of view. It's not so much that she thinks about the truth as that she embodies it. Not so much that she studies universals as that her personal attitude is tinged with universality and untainted by pettiness, kind of like Socrates. Maybe you've known someone like that. They can change one's life. Mitch Albom did, and the book Tuesdays with Morey describes that experience and how it changed his life. My ancient civilization professor, Professor John Mattingly, was that for me. A transformational force at every level that I had ever thought of. How to cultivate breadth of soul like Mr. Mattingly's, like Professor Maury Schwartz. How to grow out of pettiness and into universality. According to Plato, that's what education should be all about, drawing out of students their own individually nuanced, as yet unrecognized, unfolding inner path. According to the educational philosopher John Dewey was the same, and Sophia Lyon Foss, his student, who is really the heart of Unitarian Universalist religious education, child-centered and about drawing the truth, the inner truth, the identity out of the kid. For Plato, the true teacher was kind of a midwife. Teaching was never about laying a corpus of data on people, no matter how brilliantly conceived. The best teaching, rather, is always about recognizing and nurturing the seeds planted deep within each student's psyche or soul of his or her future growth. The sophists, meanwhile, came at things entirely differently. They did not see how the soul had anything to do with it. For them, teaching was simply a commercial enterprise. They sold their skills as teachers to wealthy Athenians so that their sons might learn music, literature, dance, the natural sciences, as well as debate and rhetoric. The sophists argued by the use of reason and deception to persuade others to agree with a certain point of view. For the sophists, teaching was kind of a contest and, in essence, a commercial transaction. If they persuaded people more effectively, well, that made them better teachers who deserved more money. Truth? Truth had nothing to do with it. The method of the sophists The methods of sophists are still popular today among people who see the democratic experiment as little more than a commercial opportunity and the human soul as but a potential consumer. TV's Sean Hannity and radio's Rush Limbaugh are two of the most popular modern-day sophists. Captivating, yes, and persuasive, but at what cost? They tear down their opponents, overwhelm, harangue, bedazzle, and act affronted. More than anything else, they lead their listeners away from critical issues by using market and pull-driven images and buzzwords that incite emotion and turn off critical thinking. They're sophists. Maybe that's not such a damnable thing to call a person nowadays, but it should be. What does this mean practically? Well, for one thing, it helps explain the months and months of sophistry and bullshit that our nation's been going through and that will be going and that will soon be going into hyperdrive over the course of the year ahead. The use of manipulative images, bogus data, and mock indignation in an effort to get people to vote without thinking, or without thinking very deeply at all. There is another way to consider these things. A couple of years ago, I reread Harper Lee's 1961 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. My mom read it to us that summer in 61 at our little cabin in funky, no electric, no plumbing cabin in Pennsylvania. But she would read to us, and that was one of the last that we let her read to us. And I also read it a few years later in high school. And then this most recent time, I actually listened to it, read by Sissy Spacek, on a long automobile trip. What struck me with this reading, or listening, was the author's craft at quickly building and releasing dramatic tension. Characters come into conflict, and then it's resolved. Tension, release. Tension, release. And the tension, again and again, comes from the myriad pressure points of race and class and outlook and background that are part of any community, every community. It's by virtue of that dynamic tension, creative tension, that step-by-step incremental progress is made. One of the lies of sophists everywhere is that the political landscape would be better if their ideology, whatever it is, left or right, won out, and people espousing other points of view somehow just disappear. Our Unitarian Universalist faith has never believed in such an idea. We don't want to eliminate those with whom we disagree. We want to live in community with them. Keep in mind the values of democracy are reason, compromise, and conciliation. Finding consensus and cutting a deal. Working things out between all the contending parties. This is the opposite of sophistry. Earlier I mentioned Alfred North Whitehead. Whitehead interpreted Albert Einstein philosophically. You know, lived in a Newton world. And it was all linear, sequential, and formal deductive systems, and then everything's relative. And somebody had to come up with a philosophical framework to make sense of that, and Alfred North Whitehead did with his book Process and Reality, which Whitehead was 62 years old when he got hired to Harvard to teach. And to my knowledge, he'd never written a book on philosophy. He was hired to teach philosophy. He'd never taken a class in philosophy, but he had taken Einstein into a philosophical understanding. And out of that work came Process Theology, which, like feminist theology and covenantal theology, is basically about relationship, about finding ways to live and be in healthy relationship, right relationship, where there's a place for hierarchy and individuality, but a place balanced by feelings and by political structures that promote collective solidarity. Such a view sees our country's progress and health as coming not from the triumph of any one group over another or of any one particular ideology over another, but considers all progress, all advances in the democratic experiment to come from the creative tension between contending groups. It's the tension that generates the creative juice. The tension between Alexander Hamilton's proto-republican capitalist ideology and Thomas Jefferson's democratic collectivist tradition. The tension between individuality and living in covenant. The tension between liberty and equality. I remember when the award-winning movie Forrest Gump came out, Alabama Senator Richard Shelby, still around, waltzed poetic about how Forrest, Tom Hanks, represented the kind of person that made America great. In contrast to his lifelong love interest, Jenny, played by Robin Wright. But Senator Shelby, to my Unitarian Universalist mind, missed the whole point. That what made and still makes America great is the creative tension generated by the love between the down-to-earth Forrest types and the new age, mercurial, imaginative Jenny type. They're both part of it. It's the tension, not the winning of one over the other. Now, there are sophists on both sides of the political spectrum. Believe me, I lived in Berkeley for 9 years. Who would take no hostages. Ignore those people. There are sophists who would hold anyone hostage who dares to think critically. In her novel, Harper Lee equates such behavior with the heartless and senseless killing of a mockingbird. All this applies internally in our own lives and externally in all the communities in which we live, in our families, in our congregational community here, as well as in America at large. Positive energy comes from turning conflict into creative contrast, and then crafting something cool and new and liberating out of the creative tension, driving it all. Let that be our goal here at ESUC, to turn our struggles into creative ones built on mutual care and respect. And let us hope and pray and endeavor to make the same true for the United States of America. So may it be. Shalom. Salam. Namaste. Amen.